Now, someone here yesterday talked too long and we didn't finish what we were supposed to. Because if you look at your outline and study themes, I had down three things for study one: the church I'd like, the situation I'm in, and living like Christ. And we only got A and B done, and we've got to try and pick up C, as well as do A and B of study two. So that's the task ahead of us. And so, ladies and gentlemen, that's where we're up to. Number C, living like Christ, and we're going to pick it up from verse 27 of chapter 1. And you can see that there are just four verses there to polish off that chapter. And it goes like this. Whatever happens, Paul says to the Philippians, conduct yourselves in a manner worthy of the gospel of Christ. Then whether I come and see you or only hear about you in my absence, I will know that you stand firm in one spirit, contending as one man for the faith of the gospel, without being frightened in any way by those who oppose you. This is a sign to them that they will be destroyed, but that you will be saved, and that by God. For it has been granted to you on behalf of Christ not only to believe on him, but also to suffer for him, since you are going through the same struggle you saw I had, and now hear that I still have. Really, verse 29 is sort of like the central thought there. Have a look at that for a moment, please. What does it say? It has been granted to you on behalf of Christ, not only to believe on him, but also to suffer for him. Well, that's a lovely grant, isn't it? You know, we all like getting gifts, but what a gift from Christ. He says, it's been granted to you. You've been given a good gift to suffer for him. I thought, oh, Skulk, we can do without that one. But that's really what this is all about. He's really saying that suffering is part of the Christian's lot. Part of the Christian's lot. Now, he's not thinking of suffering in general, you know, like ill health or losing your job or something like that. He's talking about suffering for Christ's sake. That's what he's talking about. It's suffering for your faith. So that when he says whatever happens in verse 27, whatever happens, in other words, when persecution comes, no matter how bad it is or how light it is or whatever, stand firm in the faith, verse 27. Conduct yourselves in a manner worthy of the gospel, so that whether I come or not, I will know that you're still standing firm and you're standing together, contending as one man. So he says when persecution comes for Christ's sake, then stand together and stand firm. Don't be frightened. Here's a funny verse, verse 28. Don't be frightened of them, without being frightened anyway, by your persecutors, because this is a sign to them that they will be destroyed, but that you will be saved. Your persecution for Christ, he's saying, is a sign that you're on the right track. It's a sign that God is saving you. What a peculiar thing, because we usually think the reverse. You go through hard times or whatever, you think, oh, crumbs. Is this what being a Christian is? You know, God's abandoned me. And he's saying, no, 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 get it round the right way. Does it remind you of a verse in Hebrews somewhere? A bit early in the morning, Hebrews 12, for the Lord chastens those that he loves. Do you remember that one? Hebrews 12, 6? Yes. It's just like fathers do. Not only to relieve their feelings, but also to help their sons. All right. We all know about that, don't we? Whether on the receiving or the giving end. And so he's saying, look, this suffering for your faith is a sign that you're on the right track. Now, we don't know too much about this in Australia. Like, we've got all blank faces over this because we don't suffer much for our faith. When did you last suffer for your faith, I wonder? I mean, really suffer. I mean, did the neighbour next door ever hurl a brick through your window because you went to church? Or did anyone ever give you a string of abuse because you said, I love Jesus? Or call you a religious nut? Or did you get sacked from work because you're... No, we hardly know anything about this. I remember the first time ever I heard a Richard Wurmbrand. And the troubles he'd been through in Romania for his faith, and I came away crushed by that meeting. And I thought, suffer for Christ? I don't know anything about this. I don't know anything about suffering for the Lord. So we don't know much about it. But ask a brother, ask a sister in communist China, ask some that are in Russia today, ask some in Muslim country, and this word here that means so little to us, it becomes alive, see? It's pregnant with meaning. And they say, oh, that's right. And verses that we would skip over are precious to people in these countries because they know the reality of what Paul was talking about. Well, we haven't got time to delay there because he's going on, you see, these instructions about living the Christian life. And he's saying in chapter 2, verses 1 to 4, that you've got to promote unity by humbly serving one another. Promote unity by humbly serving one another. Look at chapter 4 and verse 2 for a kickoff. Chapter 4 and verse 2. Do you see in chapter 4 and verse 2 that there were two ladies there who didn't really get on very well together? Euodia and Syntyche. Two girls. Two young women, two older women, I don't know, but they were of the aggressive female type. And what is more frightening, gentlemen, than to meet a woman in full flight? And here you have these two, there were loggerheads in the church. They were two probably very fine Christians, aggressive for the Lord, you know, the sort of organising, go-getter type of woman you meet from time to time. You see on the road sometimes passing you down the freeway, you know. It worries you, particularly if they've got a bit of white in their hair. They're goers. And if you've got them in the church, praise the Lord, because they'll get a lot done. But as long as they're in parallel courses and not on a collision course, eh? Yeah, that's the way I see these two. That's reading a little bit between the lines. All right. Euodia and Syntyche. So they had these problems of a division in the church. There were personality clashes and whatever. Now that's just to give the background to chapter 2 where we're up to, because here he's talking about unity and the need for unity. Now, what's the solution? He said, look, if you have any encouragement about being united with Christ, when we come to Christ, aren't we supposed to be united? If there's any comfort from his love, if there's any fellowship in the Spirit, the Holy Spirit brings us into one fellowship, you see, when we become Christians. If there's any tenderness and compassion because we love one another, verse 2, then make my joy complete by being like-minded. Be unified. Have the same love. Being one in spirit and purpose. So if you've been united as brothers and sisters in the Lord, you're his family, if there's a fellowship of the Spirit, you should show this unity. You should work for unity. Now, he gives them a clue about how to do it. Verses 3 and 4. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. You see, self-centeredness is what causes division. Insisting on things my way and doing it my way, out for my own gratification, for my own prestige. See, don't do that, because self-centeredness causes division. But where does unity come from? But in humility, consider others better than yourselves. Each of you should not look to your own interests, but you should also look for the interests of others. Unity comes by humbly serving one another. Now, there's nothing surer. And nothing sure in this world except, you know, death and taxes, as I say. But within the parameters of that, there's nothing surer of that which will promote unity than humbly serving one another. You know, we used to have an interesting character here in Queensland. He was a minister. His name was Bob Stewart. I don't know if any of you knew Bob. He's now with the Father in glory. He retired from Queensland, he was an American, went back to America, and he died some time ago and went to glory. But before he got to Queensland, he was with several years with the United Aborigines Mission, I think the UAM in Western Australia. I think somewhere around about the Kalgoorlie area, but I'm a bit vague about that. He may be moved around a bit. But Bob had something like 20 years or something there. And on one occasion he was telling us, and it probably was at a minister's fraternal school of theology, something like that, but he was telling us that on one occasion he went out with a hunting party of Aborigines. They had their spears and goodness knows what, and he was going out with them through that low scrub in that West Australia area. He said, but there was one fellow in that party he did not trust. He said, this Aborigine, he didn't like the look of him. You know how you sometimes don't take to people, and other times you do? He said he just didn't like the look of him. He had that look on his face and he was suspicious. And Bob said, I always kept one eye over my shoulder, watching him. He said, and we were going through the scrub when suddenly, he said, this fellow flung himself on my back. He said, and we crashed to the ground. And of course I thought, oh, this is it. My suspicions have been confirmed. He said, but when I got up, what did I discover? I discover that he had taken a spear in the back, that he had seen some wild men, some wild Aborigines, lurking in the scrub. One had thrown a spear, and the only way he could stop Bob from taking that spear was to take it himself, and flung himself on his back and took it. Fortunately, he recovered. But Bob said, can you imagine what that did to the suspicion I had of that character? Can you imagine what happened? He said, all of that gap that was between us just dissipated. It just went out the window. He said, there's nothing like. And that's an exemplification of what Paul is talking about. Like the humble serving. They're an extreme case, I know, taking a spear. But the humble serving of one another, there's nothing like it for breaking down barriers. Nothing like it for promoting unity. And Paul is saying, I want to tell you, that's the way forward. And now he brings forward a better illustration than Bob Stewart with the Aborigine taking a spear. What illustration does he bring forward in verses 5, 6 and down to 11? Christ's example of humble servanthood. Your attitude in this regard, he says in verse 5, should be the same as that of Christ Jesus, who, being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped. In verse 6, he's saying Christ was in the highest position. Christ was the greatest person. Verse 7, but he made himself nothing. He took the nature of a servant and was made in human likeness. He gave up everything to serve us, transformed from a position in the heavenly throne to a vulnerable, limited human being. And verse 8, and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to death, even death on the cross. He suffered the ultimate humiliation, an innocent dying as a crucified criminal. But of course, Paul's never content to leave Jesus on the cross. And 9, 10, 11, he comes out with that great climax. Therefore God exalted him to the highest place, gave him the name that is above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow, in heaven, on earth, and under the earth, and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. And sometimes the climax of that little poem, verses 6 to 11, sometimes overshadows the fact for us that the main point that Paul is making in this respect is that Jesus is the example par excellence of humble servanthood. What other example, I wonder, of self-sacrificing servanthood could compare with Christ? So I sat down to try to think of a few. I thought of Mother Teresa and that selfless work that nun does for India's destitute. I thought about the death of a soldier in battle, dying for his country and his loved ones. I thought about that member of Scott's Antarctic party 1911-12, round about there, where he walked out into the blizzard. Do you remember the story? To save the rest of the party. Alas, it was in vain. But I tried to think of noble examples of extreme examples of serving one another. But to me, nothing can compare with what Jesus has done. Whereas I thought about the lovely Mother Teresa or the brave soldier or whatever. Did they surrender, I wondered, the position that Jesus had as the highest in the universe? Did they descend to the depth that he did? Did they experience separation from God? Yet Christ did that for us, did he not? He did it for you, and he did it for me. And by his humiliation, he has brought into one fold those that were enemies. He's brought in this one from this nation, that one from that ethnic group. He's brought in sheep from every nation. And so Jesus becomes the example of what it means to promote unity by humbly serving one another. Well, that was yesterday's effort. We took a vote yesterday whether we should spend 5 minutes on that or not. And we decided we'd put it in today. Now, we come to the next section, which is chapter 2, verse 19 to 31. I beg your pardon, chapter 2, 12 to 18, where he is giving them some instructions, some final instructions about how salvation should be worked out in daily living. Look at verse 12. What's the first word you've got in your translation, please? Therefore. Okay. Therefore, point you in which direction? Backwards. And he goes back, I guess, to verse 27 of chapter 1, this whole section about how to live for Christ, how to live Christ-like lives, and so forth. Therefore, in view of all that's gone before, of the need to suffer courageously, need to promote unity, the need to imitate Christ, he now goes on to give them some instructions, and he said these elements, these should be the characteristics of those who are saved and walking with God. And I've called it the signs of a saved person. Now look at the first one, verse 12. Therefore, my dear friends, have you already obeyed, always obeyed, not only in my presence, but now much more in my absence, continue to work out your salvation with fear and trembling. Let's focus first of all on that expression, work out your salvation. Now he doesn't say work it in. You haven't got to work in your salvation. You haven't got to work for your salvation. If you've got a Jerusalem Bible, at least if you've got my edition of the Jerusalem Bible, the editors have put a little heading at the top of here. And you know what it is? Work for salvation. Oh, that was a red rag to an evangelical eye, I can tell you when I read that. No, no, not work for salvation, but work out. Not work out in the sense of figuring it out, you know, get your pad and paper and figure it out. I think I've got that worked out now, what it means to be saved. No. Work out in the sense of what is inside the salvation which God has wrought in your soul and your spirit. It's got to come out in your daily living. That's what it means. Work it out day by day in what you do, your attitudes, and so forth. Bring out what's already in. So think about this. And my mind went back to the old days, you'll excuse this rather personal reference, when my pyjama pants used to have a cord rather than an elastic top. I'm so sorry to bring this up, but it did remind me of this. And I don't know what I used to do, but from time to time, one end of the cord would disappear down this little hole. Now, if you've ever had this experience, I tell you, it's the work of the world to get it out. You can get your little pinky down the hole, but somehow, unless you've got a claw on the end or a crochet hook, you can't fish it out. And I tell you, it's enough to make a parson swear. And to work this out, it's here a little and there. It's in, but it's got to come out. And that's what I was thinking of when I was thinking of what's in has got to come out. By the way, a tip for you. If ever you get in that position and finally it does appear through a little hole, don't give too enthusiastic a yank, because you'll have the same problem at the other end. At least that's what I've discovered. Well, Paul is saying, look, he said that salvation of yours has got to come out. But the word in the Greek also means something more. It just doesn't mean bring out, but it means bring out in a way that it's working to a completion. Like it's building to something. It is going on and going to completion, because your salvation, as you know, has got both a past, a present, and a future connotation. We've been saved in the past, we are being saved, and we shall be saved finally in heaven forever. And it's got that idea of a progression. Work it out so that it's working towards a complete end. And so the first mark then, if I can put it fairly succinctly, is this. The first mark of a saved person is that he, she is making effective progress in the Christian life. Now that's a sure sign of life, effective progress, growth. So whether we're thinking of plants in the garden or the gross national product or our children, growth, progress is a sure sign of life. And the Christians, that's fair dinkum, the Christians who's walking with the Lord, he or she will be making increasingly more effective application of the New Testament principles to his, her daily living. So that there will be the application of the rule of Christ to one's life. That person will be growing. That person's prayer life will be growing. That person's capacity for God will be growing. Of course, one of the notorious questions, or difficult questions, is to know how you're growing, whether you're growing. The measurement of such progress is notoriously difficult. You'll be asking yourself the question, I know, am I growing in the Christian life? And of course, it certainly won't be helped by trying to compare my spirituality of today with that of yesterday. I mean, we don't do that with our kids. We don't haul them out of bed when they're youngsters every morning, slam them up against the wall, bring out the tape measure. Oh dear, no apparent sign of growth from yesterday. You know, that's not the way it is. What you do to measure growth, you go, ladies, to the dusting rag bag, don't you? And you resurrect last year's trousers and try to put them on this year's loins. Or you get last year's shoes and try to jam them on this year's feet. Now, over a year you can see signs of effective growth. Or if the worst comes to worst, you invite Grandma over and she'll say, my, haven't you grown? Usually to the kid's ultimate disgust. They hate that sort of thing. I want to ask you the question, just in passing. How do you feel you are in your Christian life now compared with a year ago? That's what I'd like to ask. How have you grown in 12 months? I thought, well, I'm glad to hear it in some cases. That's great. And I could wish that we all would be able to say, look, in this particular or that particular, yes, God has led me. And I'm doing better. Praise the Lord, and I'm going on. There might be other areas where you felt that you slipped back a little. All right, but I'll leave the question with you. Effective progress, the first sign that Paul puts forward as something we should work for, and for someone who is saved and knows the Lord. Now the next thing is with fear and trembling. Oh, fear and trembling. You see, it's such a funny thing, doesn't it? I mean, he's talking about joy throughout the epistle. He's talking about being happy and rejoicing, and here he's starting to talk about fear and trembling. Why with fear and trembling? Is it, do you think, because God is vindictive and capricious? And having dangled salvation like a carrot before our nose, he will at the last minute whip it away and say, there, oh, that'll learn you not to trust anybody. Is it, oh no, that's absolutely abhorrent and we couldn't think of that. Is it because, as some commentators, as some theologians say, we are frail human beings, and if we don't keep up to the mark, although we have believed in Jesus, we may lose our salvation and finally fall away and be lost? Well, perhaps. I don't particularly subscribe to that view personally. I think that when you get saved and that's the end of it. But I'm not here to enter into a debate between Calvinism and Arminians concerning eternal security or not. We'll still be here to the next family convention talking about it. I rather think that Paul has got something else in mind. That when he's talking about fear and trembling, he's talking about a sense of the deep issues involved. Like, this business of salvation, it's not just something, you know, that's by the by. It's something about eternity. It's something about one's eternal destiny. Salvation is that which the Son of God, as we've just read about in 6, 7 and 8, gave up heaven's best for earth's worst. It's talking about the heavy business of cooperating with the God of the universe. Now here are things of great moment. These are not just by the by. These are important and weighty matters. And Paul says, oh, to have a sense. To have a sense that this whole business is something that might cause you to tremble. They say that when Robert Murray McShane, that Presbyterian, that Scottish Presbyterian gentleman of last century, was first challenged about going into the ministry, or as they used to say in those days, into holy orders, he trembled with the responsibility. Oh, ladies and gentlemen, to the non-Christian, God is of very little account. God is of very little account. Here's someone who might be around somewhere, but you don't need to worry about him. Like, from time to time he interposes in your life, and that's lucky, and thanks God, I appreciate that helping hand along the way, but generally you don't worry about it. Like, you don't think about God from one year's beginning to the end. But for the Christian, for the one who really knows God, is not God, in fact, the centre of your life? I mean, when you wake up in the morning, isn't with a sense, this is the day that the Lord has given us. Isn't it that? Okay, hopefully you pray together, you say grace with your family together, hopefully you have family devotions together, and as you walk down the road, or as you drive, I mean, when you wake up in the morning, isn't with a sense, this is the day that the Lord has given us. Isn't it that? Okay, hopefully you pray together, you say grace with your family together, hopefully you have family devotions together, and as you walk down the road, or as you drive, it's, thank you Lord, look after us today, I want to live for you. And you refer things to him during the day. When you have a problem, say, oh Lord, I don't know what to do about this. Oh Father, I've just suddenly thought of my sister or this brother. Please bless them and help them through their exam. Is it not true? Is it not true? Or should it not be true that the centre of your life through the whole of your day is Jesus, is God. And your business, my business, is cooperating with him. And oh, live a sanctified life. In a world that's gone bad, you know, really bad, to live a sanctified life is our high and our holy calling. It's nothing else than cooperating with the God of the universe and working out in our daily lives that which he is working within. And we need to feel again, I think, the awesome responsibility of our calling. So there's got to be something more than a coziness and a cuddly softness, mummy, about our salvation. Yes. Yes. let's just say that this is something that that Christians like to talk about and discuss, whether in fact Christians should fear God, and some don't like the word fear but prefer the word awe. But what I would like to say in response to your comment is that my opinion is that one of the most difficult things in the world, in our Christian life, is to hold these two things in tension. First of all, that God is my friend. He loves me, he walks with me, he is my advocate and my constant companion. And the other is an attitude towards him of respect and so forth. Now, if we were to read the book of Hebrews, we would find that although we stand this side of Calvary, and we hear a lot about fear of God in the Old Testament, although we stand this side of Calvary, there is still a note of fear in the New Testament. You read Hebrews, the writer of Hebrews says, you better watch your laurels, you better look to how you're walking, because our God is a consuming fire. You've only got to read that. You know, and think, oh, he's talking to Christians here. And so I find that I am not embarrassed or worried about the word fear in connection with God. But the problem I've got is holding the two things in tension. So that in a former age, when the fear of God and so forth was strongly emphasised by preachers, you know, that's all God became virtually, or the whole fear bit became, oh, you know, you better watch out because if you don't do the right thing, God will push you out and you have a broken leg, or, you know, God will get you. You know, you've got a cold, that's because you've been sinning, you know. And really, it's because someone sneezed down your neck in church on Sunday, or something like that. And then on the other hand, we don't really need to concern ourselves much about that side of things these days. Rather, the pendulum tends, I think, to my liking anyhow, to go too much the other way. God is my friend becomes God is me mate. And there's a great, too great familiarity. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, and to get that balance between the two. I'm so pleased you interrupted me, because I did mean to say at some stage, you know, speak up and so forth. And it's hard, I know, when I'm getting in full flight to like to halt the aeroplane in midair and have it hover. I know that, but that's all right. I don't mind that at all. And this happens at college, and sometimes the interruptions are not as gracious as I'm getting here. The next thing I want to say is that he's talking here in verse, we skip over verse 13, it's kind of an interpolation, for it is God who works in you to will and to act according to his good purpose. Then in verse 14, he comes back to what we should do. Do everything without complaining or arguing. Oh dear. I don't think he's got in mind here like the odd crossword. I mean, everyone gets their nose out of joint a bit from time to time, you know, and you love to let something slip by the by. What he's really got in mind, in my opinion, what's in the background here, I think, is the murmuring of the Israelites in the wilderness. In other words, he's talking about a steady, stated kind of constant attitude of complaining. That's what I think's in here. You remember what happened in the wilderness? The traditional word is murmur. They murmur. They didn't have any food, so what did they do? They murmured. God gave them food, so what did they do? They murmured. He gave them a lot, so what did they do? They murmured about how much they had. And so it went on and on and on. And throughout the 40 years of wandering in the wilderness, you read the passage time and time and time and time and time and time again, they murmured. Till finally came the final murmuring. God sent them into the promised land, 12 spies. They came back, and what did they do? Grumble about it. God said, oh, I'm sorry. I'm closing the door. You know, it's a finish. I've had enough of this murmuring. And it was an attitude. An attitude. Now, I think that's what he's got in mind here. He's got in mind that we shouldn't be grumblers or whingers, to use a good Australian term, but we should have serenity and certainty. Because one of the chief causes of people's complaining is uncertainty about God. They don't believe that God plans their best. Why do they complain? Because they really don't believe that God is in control and allowing things to happen to them that are happening. I pass quickly to the next one. So that if you do this, you may become blameless and pure, children of God without fault in a crooked and depraved generation. Blameless and pure. You see, in spite of a sinful environment, in the midst of a crooked and a depraved generation. The picture is not here of some embattled Christian nearly overwhelmed by the odds. That's not the way it is. The picture is neither of some exclusive brethren chap wrapping his holy garments about him in splendid isolation without being smudged by the dirty world. No, it's a picture of boldness, shining like stars. Now, you know what the stars do? They stand out and they dispel. Purity of life, then, is not pictured here as a separationist kind of holiness. Rather, it's a dynamic, forward-thrusting holiness. And it is related to being children of God. If I can say it with some due reverence, you as a child of God should be a chip off the old block. All right? The Old Testament says this. God says, be holy, for I am holy. You get the same in the New Testament. What does Paul say? Be imitators of God as dear children, says the Old Authorized Version. And you've seen kids imitate their parents. Of course you've had the experience. They come and they want to help mum. Oh, bless my soul. It's a weariness to the flesh. Or worse still, you're under the car and they come to help. And the first thing you know, they're banging into the panels of the car with a hammer, helping dad fix the car. All right. They want to imitate. They want to be like mum. They want to be like dad. And the Bible here says again, and it's one of Paul's favourite expressions, we should be chips off the old block. When we were first married, my wife got a job. We shifted to a new town. My wife got a job as secretary to the manager of Meatworks. It was starting off. And from time to time, there would come through all sorts of people to the Meatworks, such as they were at that stage, where the manager was trying to establish contact, arrange for sellers and beef and so forth. And there came through a gentleman whom my wife knew, but he didn't know her. He was a Christian. And he was in the meat trade, and he came to talk to her boss, the manager. And so they went out one half day, inspecting this, that and the other, and came back. And the manager came into Mary and said, guess what happened on the road? She said, well, what? He said, you know that lorry bloke? Yeah. So we were driving along and there were two girls hitchhiking. So I stopped and picked them up. And after a few miles down the road, one of the girls suggested that since there were two gentlemen and since there were two girls, they could have some fun time together. And of course the boss was a bit of a lecherous old toad. And, you know, he would have been in it as quick as wink one suspects. He said, you know what Laurie did? He turned round and gave him a lecture. And I think he said it with a great deal of disappointment in his voice that a golden opportunity had passed him by. But you know, ladies and gentlemen, in that car that day, there were represented the children of two families. One was the family of the devil and of this world, careless about morality. And the other was a child of God who was careful to maintain a family likeness to God who had called him to purity. Now I know that sexual purity is only one aspect of purity. I understand that. But we are called to be like him. And then lastly, is it fifth I think I've gotten up to? Fifthly, holding forth. Holding forth. Or verse 16, as you hold out. Some of your translations might say, hold on to. My translation, the NIV's got that in the margin. Have you got a footnote down there in verse 16, as you hold out or hold on to? It could be either. I'm inclined to think, though, the NIV is right, and they've opted for the more likely translation, holding forth the word of life, holding out the gospel of salvation, holding out the offer to people to be saved. Look, there's nothing, I think, that's a surer sign that people are walking with God than their desire to see other people saved too and making the offer available to them. I see Graham here, and Graham and I were down at a place years ago called the Bible College of South Australia. And there was a little Baptist church there at Victor Harbour, and it was being pastored by a graduate of the college. And after 3 years, I think it was, in college, he didn't have a brass razoo to his name, and he had an increasing horde of children that were coming along. And on one occasion, he said, "Well, I'm going to go to Melbourne for holidays." I got a bit fearful of that because I knew the state his car was in. And it was a long way from South Australia to Melbourne. Finally, anyhow, he did come back. And the next Sunday in church, he told us about an experience he had, because coming back from Melbourne, the car conked out. And he pulled it over, and there's nothing worse than a hot day, behind schedule, your car conks out, and you've got a whole seat full of kids in the back. So he did what every husband does under those circumstances. He got out and lifted the bonnet. Now, you may not know much about it, but it makes the wife feel a bit better if you do it, I found. So he looked under the bonnet, couldn't see anything easily fixable, and so they just waited. No insurance or anything like that to help them out. Until, chugging down the highway, because many transports and cars had whizzed past them, came a little utility. It nosed in just ahead of them. Farm boy got out, having some problems. "Yes," said John, "the car won't go." "I can see that." "Let's have a look." So, like many farm lads, they can turn their hands to this, that and the other. And he was able to get that going. "You should be right now." Wow, 2 hours later, behind schedule, the kids in the back, the wife a bit frantic, off they charge. Got a few miles down the road. And John said, "God spoke to me and said, 'You know, John, you spent 20 minutes or whatever it is in the company of someone who you might never see again. And you never once opened your mouth to say anything about your Lord.'" So you know what he did? He pulled over and waited. A few minutes later, chugging down the road, came that old Tilly, nosed in ahead. Lad got out. "What, not again?" "No," says John, "there's just something I forgot to tell you." And he shared with him. And as he told that story in church, I wondered, quite honestly, friends, in my own heart, what I would have done. Because I've got to be on time. I've got to make up the time. There's a schedule to be kept. That's more important than sharing the gospel. To say it in such bald terms is so soul-shattering. But I really wondered whether I wouldn't have just committed him to the Lord with a word of prayer and gone racing off to Adelaide all the same. And Paul says, "Oh, look, if these things will happen, if you will do these things, work out your salvation with fear and trembling, if you'll promote unity without complaining and arguing, if you'll be blameless and pure, if you hold out the gospel, all that will satisfy me." Said, verse 16, "I'll then be able to say that I didn't run or labour for nothing. I didn't put all this work in and this effort in for nothing, but it's paid off and people are going on with the Lord and the gospel is growing and the church is growing." He said, because I want you to know, verse 17, "I am being poured out like an offering." We're all aware of animal sacrifices.
a goat or a kid, throat slit, and burnt on an altar. We understand that very clear about that. Some of us even know that there were cereal offerings where you took grain and you burnt that. Not everybody is aware there are also drink offerings, usually in association with an animal sacrifice, where wine or water or oil was poured out. And this is the picture here, if you can get hold of it. I am being poured out like a drink offering. In other words, my life is being poured out, my energies and all that I have being poured out on the sacrifice and service coming from your faith. And in the imagery, your coming to Christ and your service for Him is like an offering, like a sacrifice. We sometimes use the word sacrifice as if, you know, oh, hang it, we made a loss. You know, I've got this Buick car and I sacrificed it for $10,000. You know, and that's not what sacrifice basically means in the Bible. Sacrifice is basically that which is freely given and is pleasing to God. And so their service, their faith, is that which is pleasing, an offering to God. You've come to faith, and it's pleasing to God, and I'm being poured out, but I don't care. I'm glad and rejoice with all of you for my pains, for my labours, for my everything, because I'm seeing Christ in you. I'm finishing with this. We got one more left over now for tomorrow. Are they going to schedule anything for Saturday? Dear, oh dear. Years ago, when I was in the ministry, pastor of a church, busy, 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 suddenly the Lord spoke to me and said, you know that man who led you to the Lord, that old Bible teacher? Why don't you say thanks to him? Thought, oh Lord, I haven't got time. I've got to do this, that and the other. And he lives, you know, miles away. No, go and do it. So one afternoon, without any warning, I just lobbed on his front doorstep. Went up, the door was open. Oh, Stan, come in. What a surprise to see you. Went in. I said, you know, Mr. Marin, I want to say thank you for faithfully telling me the gospel when I was a young lad in Sandgate Baptist Church down the road there. And I want to say thank you. Thank you for leading me to the Lord. He said to me, Stan, it's very nice to get your thanks. I appreciate you coming. But my greatest thanks is this, dear brother, that you not only accepted the Lord, but you've gone on with Him. Paul's in the same situation. He said, you've come to Christ, but you're going on, and it's cost me a lot, but I don't care. I'm glad. I rejoice. I'm being poured out because you're growing in Him.